Great. Okay, so I do a little intro, and then basically I'm just going to ask you to talk about, to introduce Pomegranate Arts, and then we can go from there. Okay.
Sure. Well, very flattered, actually, to be a part of this, because we rarely are asked, actually, what we do. And I think the performing arts sector of how work is made and how it's produced in the non-for-profit arts sector, which is where we tend to live, although we are not a non-for-profit company, we are a small corporation, which is also unusual in the independent and creative producer sector. It's really lovely to be asked, because we rarely are. So thank you for that.
Could you take us on the journey of how you got
the thing that I learned about being a producer? Kind of
whatever it's taken to get to this point.
A completely different perspective.
That's my job.
Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast.
Hi, it's Huron. Thanks for joining us to meet today's producing hero, Linda Brumback. Linda is founder and director of Pomegranate Arts, an independent production company based in New York City, from where she's talking to us today. I'm thrilled to have Linda on the show because, as you will hear, she has caused some significant beauty and wonder to exist on stages around the world. Let's find out how. I'm fascinated. Do you want to introduce what Pomegranate Arts is and talk us through the company?
Yes, absolutely. I started Pomegranate Arts 22 years ago now with my longtime friend and colleague, Elisa Regas, in 1998. And Elisa and I had both worked at another company for, I was there 15 years as one of the producing directors called International Production Associates, created by Jed Wheeler and Robert Lobianco. And Elisa had been there for about 5 years. So Jed is now a presenter. He's actually a presenter, runs Peak Performances in my town, just about a mile away from where I'm sitting right now. And I decided after many, many years of working for Jed that it was time that I really wanted to break out on my own and do my own thing. And we were in London at the Barbican Center producing a production with Robert Wilson and Philip Glass at the time called Monsters of Grace. And a very dear friend of mine, Michael Morris, called me up and said, we are workshopping this new piece that I'm producing with your friend, the Improbable Theater that Elisa and I had brought to America for the first time and worked with on a few beautiful productions called 70 Hill Lane and then Hanging Man and some other work that they had created. And they were doing a new production called Shockheaded Peter. And would we come and see an early workshop of the show? And Elisa and I left London and went to the tramway to see the work. And I came back to London that night and decided that I was going to start my company so I could bring Shockheaded Peter to America. I was so completely and utterly smitten with the work and the work that they had done with the Tiger Lilies after I had met the Tiger Lilies, in fact, at the Adelaide Festival when Robin Archer was there and had a wonderful accordion late night session. So all of these worlds had come together. My work with Improbable Theater at IPA, my friendship over the years with Michael Morris, the connection to the Tiger Lilies, and when I went to see this early version, I decided to start my own company simply to bring Shockheaded Peter to America without a big vision, actually. I just wanted to do this. And I got a phone call from Philip Glass right at the time that I was breaking out on my own. And he said to me, I would love to give you a home. We had worked together for years at IPA and Jed was now becoming a presenter. And Philip was deciding what he was going to do and who was going to be in charge of his producing world and the touring of his international productions. And he offered me space in his recording studio in New York in the Looking Glass, which was an incredible, generous moment and place, an opportunity for me. And I decided to move into Philip's recording studio. And that was the beginning, actually, of Pomegranate. I thought I was going to be home in my tiny studio with a little bridge table on my couch trying to figure out a way to do Shockheaded Peter. And I had this amazing opportunity to merge those worlds of my past experience with Philip Glass and my new world with the Improbable Theater. So that was the beginning of Pomegranate. There were many parts that contributed to that. We had a lot of interest in many different worlds, Elisa and I, in theater, in dance, in performance art, in music. And we were very interested in long-term relationships with artists and kind of deeper strategic building of works over a period of time that we could establish those ideas with the artists. So that was the early beginning of Pomegranate.
Amazing. I love any story that features the line, I got a phone call from Philip Glass. And one of the words that's become very important, or I'd say every producer has used the word friendship. And it's obvious that you're friends with a lot of amazing people. Were you friends with them before they were famous? Were you friends with them as they were becoming famous? Are they famous because they were friends with you?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I realized. I think each artist has a very unique story and, I guess, relationship to the word celebrity. And I think it's worked in both, for sure. For me, it's worked on both sides. I was a music major in college. So when I studied music, I went to a conservatory where we stopped everything really at Bartok. So I think Philip Glass and Steve Reich probably shared one sentence and it was not to be discussed. So he was actually not famous when I was in school. And I didn't realize how famous he might have been when I started working with him. It was very new to me when I came to New York. So I really was, I guess, not as nervous as perhaps I would have been if I was in a room with Leonard Bernstein, for instance. But I realized very quickly that he was quite well known. And I met Philip well after he had created the original Einstein on the Beach. I met him, the first production we worked on together was 1,000 Airplanes on the Roof. So I've known him now for 33 years. I've produced or I've toured and worked with him on over 20 productions over that time. So you become family. You become close. There's a level of trust that you have, I think, with an artist over time that is, you don't really think about him as a celebrity. But I remember when we were doing a few projects, like one of them was Book of Longing. And when we were building and opening the Luminato Festival in 2007, we had produced the opening event, which was a collaboration with Philip and Leonard Cohen. I was shaking to meet Leonard Cohen. I mean, it was the first time I met him was, you know, I was very, very nervous. And there are very few people, I think, that in my world with Philip that I felt that way about. I think it was, you know, because Philip's recording studio, he was sharing the second studio at the Looking Glass was Tony Visconti's studio. So the first 5 years of Pomegranate, we did share a floor with David Bowie and Tony Visconti and Philip. So that was, you know, yes, I was very much aware of the celebrity in the room, but it wasn't. It's an interesting question. I think there's a comfort level with different people. And the better you get to know them, the more it just becomes very clear that you're just people working together and trying to do your best.
It does seem to be a cohort of visionary presenters who must go along on this journey with you.
And I guess I would say that one of the most important parts of my life, my professional life, have been the peers that I grew up with. Besides my mentors that really inspired me, the mentors like the Joe Melillos and the Harvey Lichtensteins and Jed Wheelers in my life, my peers are the people that are the ones that are supporting the development of new work in partnership with me. They are the Christy Edmonds, the Michael Conjocas, the Chris Lorways, the Jonathan Holloways, the Mark Balls. They are peers that I grew up with that I really value and trust and have been there for me and my company to support and trust me as presenters. And without them, I would never be able to do what I do. Honestly, it's very, very real for me that we grew up together. You know, I took Christy to Australia for the first time. She met Roz. There's a whole history there. I've been to every one of her festivals in Melbourne. She has been an inspiration to me and given me strength. Our peers in presenters and my peers like Janet Capelwaith from the Kronos Quartet, who are my go-to peer group. When I don't know the right thing to do or I feel like I'm challenged, that's my group. So you, no doubt, have your group, but that is a group who has made everything I do possible with sincerity.
I'd like to go back to Pomegranate and from a slightly different perspective, which is why is it named after a fruit and why isn't it called Linda Brumback Productions?
You know, when I started Pomegranate, it happened to have been Rosh Hashanah weekend in 1998 at the end of September. And I'm not a religious person at all, but I grew up celebrating Rosh Hashanah and always loved the idea of this being the final fruit of summer that soaks up the sun to begin something new. And there were things about it that I've always connected. I know at the time it wasn't that trendy in 1998, but I always loved the graphic of it. And I love the idea of, I think, I don't know, 613 seeds inside, the idea of the messiness and that in order to produce work, you actually have to get a stain on your hands, on your skin. And the stain and the messiness is part of the work that I really like to do. That in order to look at this beautiful outside, that's one thing, that's one beautiful object, but I've always been more attracted to the mess inside. So
that makes perfect sense. I think the other side of it that I suggest is that producers often are not the largest ego in the room. It's interesting for people, a group of people who control the budgets, engage the marketing team and make the thing happen, that as a species, they are not more famous.
Well, first of all, I never do anything alone. So I would say that I'm a pack animal and I have been very blessed to work with a great group of people that do the work with me. And that is outside of the obvious connection to the partnership with the artist, because everything does start with the artist and the vision of the artist. But that partnership for Pomegranate, I've always really loved to put teams of people together to help realize a vision for an artist. And that is our team, but that is also the family and the community that makes up a company to make work with the artist. Because a lot of the work that we do is often in companies that don't exist on their own, except for that work. So even with Einstein on the Beach, of course, there are elements with the Philip Glass Ensemble or the Lucinda Childs Dance Company and elements that come together. But that company needs to become a company for a period of time that in deep trust that you have to hold as the producer and sustain and care for. It's a very interesting relationship to me. And I often felt like my job as producer, and I don't know if this has served me well, actually. But for years, and this is part of the reason that I didn't use my name, and also because I was starting a company with a dear friend, Elisa Regas, I felt like if we were doing our job well, you didn't actually know we were in the room. I felt very strongly that the artist should always be front and center, and that everything we do would be setting things up perfectly as we could, even though the word perfect is questionable because there's a great role of imperfection and failure as well. That's part of the journey, as you know. But I did feel like if we were doing our job well, we were not noticed. I don't know if that's actually served us so well.
It strikes me that the gift of invisibility is not necessarily a very good way to make a presence or become known always in a world particularly that is, you know, about the clamor of the ego.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah. I mean, and I think that also with Pomegranate, there was a decision in the beginning of how do you structure a company? I'm not a business person. I didn't come from business school. I was a music major. I think I kind of have a little bit of a different rock and roll mindset. I also never worked for a company, so I have no experience in any kind of corporate culture. And I think for me, setting up the company as a small corporation, I felt like I would be able to be completely nimble and completely able to work on a timeline with an artist. So by not setting up a 501c3 company and waiting for grants potentially to tell me what I could or couldn't do, I didn't really have the patience for it. So I wasn't, it has served me well in terms of moving in a timeline quickly with the artists and be able to navigate that and looking at the ecology of what partnerships make sense in that kind of timeline. But it also in a time like this, which is very interesting, like a major pandemic, where a company that actually is not eligible for arts and culture funding because we're not a 501c3. So there are cracks in the systems that reveal themselves that are interesting, just interesting in certain times of the ecosystem and the landscape.
Yeah. You know, I think at the core of any producing effort, there is an act of heroic kind of Promethean chutzpah where you say, we can bring this fire into the world somehow. Can you talk to us about any of those moments when the outer voice was saying it's going to happen and the inner voice was saying, I have no idea how?
Absolutely. I think of all the projects we've done at Pomegranate, the two that really speak to that moment for me have been the new production of Einstein on the Beach and have been Taylor Mack's 24-decade history of popular music. Those are the two. And they're so different. They're so different in how they were built, how they were structured, what that path was, what that trajectory was, what the various pipelines were available to us. They were works that when you look at them on paper, they're sort of unproducible. I mean, you look at them and feel like in the systems that exist or people that would come to us would say they're unproducible. And that to me is the most inspiring place to be. I am most inspired by working with an artist to figure out the path of something that is supposed to be unproducible. And of course, these works are just completely different. I mean, Einstein on the Beach was originally, I wasn't the original producer of Einstein on the Beach. It was done in 1976. You know, although this is a work that is considered one of the most important works of the 20th century in opera, there hasn't to date, or at least that I know of, been an opera company that's produced in-house their version of Einstein. I think the Met, it was a rental. Bob Wilson did a Dark Monday Night and it went to Europe. In 1984, Harvey Lichtenstein and Joe Melillo produced it at BAM's Opera House without the traditional operatic structure of having an orchestra or choir or crew on staff. And then 20 years later, when we did our production, you know, part of that journey was because we had these three major contemporary American artists whose mothership, if you will, or one of the great masterpieces that has defined a lot of their careers with Philip Glass, Robert Wilson, and Lucinda Childs, that work had never been seen in America yet, outside of New York, Brooklyn, and two preview performances in 1992 at Princeton. So not anywhere in the Midwest or the West Coast. And it was just unbelievable to me that this work had not been experienced in their own country and that we might not have another opportunity to do so. And Joe was actually, you know, was on this roller coaster ride with me. But having an opportunity to produce a work these years later, to start something up 37 years later with three living contemporary artists who created this masterpiece and now could repaint it. Because we often don't see these works in repertoire. We don't see them coming back like symphonies keep performing in rep. Different symphonies, operas have work in rep. But something like Einstein on the Beach, it became very apparent to me that this is probably the last opportunity we may have in our lives to do this while the three of them can champion this work. And I wanted to find a way to do it. So that was a very interesting and very inspiring and challenging opportunity. And Taylor's 24-decade history of popular music was something that we built with him along the way. And that's been a very challenging and absolutely rewarding experience over the last 8 years. In each of those works, I would say there were times that we just didn't think they were happening. The challenges were too severe. And there were things that stopped us, you know, almost stopped us along the way, but we just kept going to try to figure it out. And I would say they've been absolutely the most satisfying. And have also probably had the most impact on many artists and makers and generations who were part of that experience, either with us or in the audience. So
let's dive into Einstein a bit. The 2012 remount of Einstein was a tenacious and remarkable effort. It took over a decade to make. That's a crazy amount of time to put into something. What made you do it? And can you talk us through any of the kind of stories along the way? Because the decades are, you know, a long time to gather some anecdotes.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the first things I wanted to do after we had brought Shock-Headed Peter to America when the company started was Elise and I started looking at trying to remount Einstein on the Beach and seeing if we could bring together partners in America to help commission and rebuild the work. And we started by having a workshop at Watermill, and I've known Bob for many years. And we were invited with Philip and Lucinda Childs, the choreographer. And you probably know Lucinda was not the original choreographer in Einstein. It was Andy DeGroat, but she starred in it both as an actress and as a lead dancer in all of the productions since this time, 76, 84, 92. And Lucinda was asked to choreograph the work for the BAM production in 84, which really became that iconic version of Einstein with the three of them. So right around the beginning of of Pomegranate, we started working on putting together a team to see if we could rebuild the work. And it turned out that the original model of Einstein on the Beach was accidentally destroyed. So we had to start from the beginning and go into the archive and rebuild the model. We had gotten pretty far, about 70% of the funding together, when 9/11 happened. And after 9/11, it had a very big impact on the funding of the arts institutions that we were working with in the performing arts. And things were feeling a bit vulnerable in terms of making commitments to work of this scale. So things got a little bit safer. People really felt more comfortable in their Broadway series than doing anything as risky as Einstein on the Beach, which we had started to tackle with the new production, but we had to put a pause on it. So a few years later, I think it was 2007, Gerard Mortier was appointed the head of New York City Opera. And he called me and basically said that he wanted to open his season with something as bold as Einstein on the Beach, and he would be the executive producer, and would we build it? And it was thrilling to me because I actually had never had anyone ask me, we're going to pay for something. You don't have to raise the money to do it. And you can build this with the creative team and we will premiere it. So we had started down that path. We were thrilled. We had worked with Lucinda because the first task at hand was Lucinda Childs had disbanded her dance company about a decade ago. She hadn't had a dance company in years. So we needed to put together a dance company for Lucinda because she felt very strongly that for the dancers to be safe and to have the rigor to execute Einstein on the Beach, this almost 6-hour opera where the dancers are playing an enormous part in multiple roles, they would have to work with her for 2 years to get the methodology down in her craft and be able to execute Einstein. So we essentially had to start a dance company. We put auditions together and that was the first step. And then Mortier resigned and he left New York City Opera and the entire season was canceled. So that's when Joe Melillo called me up and said, Linda, do not give up. This has to happen. It absolutely has to happen. And BAM will be one of your partners on this. So we had a dance company all dressed up with no place to go at that point and decided, while I now go into fundraising mode for Einstein on the Beach, I am going to see if we could find a way to keep Lucinda's dance company together. The Philip Glass Ensemble already existed, of course, since 1968. We will then start with the fundraising piece and see if we can get the partners together and then go back to Watermill and start building the model and see if we can make this happen. At that point, a dear friend, Tammy Dillon at Bard College, decided that she was going to apply for the last endowment for the National Endowment of the Arts here in America. Used to have funding called American Masterpieces, and there were these $100,000 grants. And she was going to apply to get this grant to restore the Solowit film that was a collaboration in a piece called Dance that Lucinda Childs created with Philip Glass and Solowit in 1979. This was an extraordinary piece, and also the first piece Lucinda used music to. She only choreographed in silence up until she did Einstein and met Philip Glass. And they had such an incredible connection together that they decided to do a work together, which was Dance. So Dance is a 65-minute, you know, absolutely stunning work. And Bard decided that they would go for this grant and invite this dance company, which we had just put together, thinking we would use them for Einstein, to come for 5 weeks and premiere this work. So this amazing moment happened where the new production of Dance became an absolute success. We were able to tour it all over the world for 2 years and keep this dance company together while I was out trying to fundraise for Einstein. And that work, which at 1979 got a terrible review in the New York Times, actually. Lucinda remembers tomatoes being thrown at the company. The critic from the New York Times actually came back and apologized for his horrible review and gave it a stunning review as one of the great masterpieces of dance. And the Whitney Museum decided that they were going to create an exhibition of a dance work for the first time, which was this work that Lucinda created with Solowit and Philip Glass in 1979. So we had this incredible moment in Renaissance where Lucinda hadn't had this company, and now we were on this journey together. So partnerships came together. I raised the money to do it. We began the process and we put together 6 partnerships to help commission Einstein on the Beach and went to Watermill to meet with Bob and Philip and Lucinda. And it was very interesting in terms of their ideas and their approach for what this would be. Immediately, we knew that we had a task where Einstein, that was quote unquote unproducible, was set up to load in over 9 days of time. So we knew that in the American market and the venues that we had to work with, we had to rebuild the production so it logistically could set up in 3 days and just be manageable when we're moving, you know, and putting together a company of 70 people. It was also clear that it came clear that Lucinda was not going to be performing in this new production. And that she, who has always been the lead, one of the lead actresses and the solo dance moments, that part could be split between a dancer and an actress. So already Bob was coming back to it with a bit of a different lens. He had very different ideas about repainting and relighting the work and using instruments that he was using now, adding more color. Philip Glass had only performed in Einstein. So it became very clear to me that Philip had actually never seen it before. And it was amazing, actually, sitting next to him in Ann Arbor, which was one of our commissioning partners, the University Musical Society, and gave us an extraordinary residency to do the final tech rehearsals in Ann Arbor and some preview performances, and just sitting next to Philip Glass and watching him see Einstein on the Beach for the first time in his life, along with Lucinda, who hadn't seen it. They were always in it. So it was an amazing journey to put that together. I think that we went through many, many challenges with opening the show. Bob had a long-term stage manager, Sue Jane Stoker, who was an extraordinary person. And you know, as an artist, that your stage manager is almost like your creative partner for so many works and productions along the way. And Sue Jane had done so many Bob Wilson productions, but her dream was to do Einstein on the Beach. And she was meticulous and it was happening. And we got through all the rehearsals in New York with the choir, the ensemble, the actors, the dance company, building the crew and putting together. And after the preview performances, right before the world premiere in Montpellier, Sue Jane suddenly passed away. So we were faced with finding, you know, someone to execute one of the hardest stage management jobs in the history of opera. And it was really devastating. And
overseen by the not very critical eye of Bob Wilson, I imagine. I can't imagine it's a job many stage managers would. I imagine everyone wants to do it, but no one who would enter without a degree of terror.
Absolutely. And it's also, it was a non-union production. So even finding a stage manager with that level of experience, we actually had to take someone out of retirement who was the head of stage management at a university to come back and do it after interviewing about 28 people. But it was interesting because Bob had very clear ideas about how he wanted to repaint the production and what it would mean for him for casting. Lucinda had this new company that was about to execute this work for the first time, and they were extraordinary. It was also, you know, really remarkable with Philip to get through the auditions. I remember just being absolutely blown away. I was working with the soprano of the Philip Glass Ensemble, Lisa Bialava, who helped organize the auditions for the choir. We had about 128 voices come in, and Philip just couldn't believe. No, I couldn't believe it either, because I remember being in the auditions in 1992, hearing the quality of voices that could execute Philip Glass music today at that time in 2011 during the auditions, which was not the case in any of the earlier productions in terms of the experience of the audition, not the actual work. But Philip was so fascinating because he said, you know, I've always composed in patterns of twos and threes. And now we have a generation 20 years later that's grown up in digital sound and digital worlds that have patterns that are very similar to how he's composed. And he felt like things shifted, that people at the auditions really understood his craft harmonically and in the rhythmic patterns that he hadn't heard before, because it was a generation that grew up in his work. And it was similar with the violinist. We had actually never brought in a woman to audition for the role of Einstein. But Jennifer Coe, who's one of the great classical musicians and interpreters of Bach, we were introduced to Jennifer by one of our commissioning partners, and I started listening to her recordings and asking Philip and Bob if they would be open to a woman in this role and an Asian woman in this role. And she came in to the audition, and, you know, it was just unbelievable. They were in tears listening to her transform that score. Because at the time, of course, in 1976, you didn't have major classical musicians playing Philip's music. So when you have someone at the top level of virtuosic playing come in and transform that work, it was a really beautiful opportunity to revisit this work with them. So Jennifer did play that role of Einstein.
Do you think that the world caught up to Philip and Lucinda, or that they changed the world so that it had no choice but to have them embodied inside their, you know, in their hearing and seeing? Is it a little from column A and a little from column B?
I think if you do something long enough, eventually the world catches up.
I'm hoping for this.
You know, yeah. I think it's interesting. I mean, there's certainly a shift when you see the path and a very unique, singular voice of an artist and the impact that they've had on culture over the years, and how, you know, I think it's beautiful what you could see the trajectory of the work. We've all come from a place. I mean, you know, you could look at Philip's work and go back to Bach and Mozart and, you know, all of those influences. But with the work that they were doing with Einstein, you know, and something that did have actually traditional form to it and structure, but the way they broke the rules on every level of narrative, of audience being permitted to come and go, in what those, not using a traditional opera orchestra, an electronic band, not using a traditional choir, having an entire dance company interpret, having the crew have to be a part of the transitions, having the transitions with a crew on stage be as important as the actual scenes in between, that was part of the experience. You could see in that work, how much work has come out of it all these years later. And when we built this production of Einstein, we weren't on a path. We're never on a path at Pomegranate to say, oh, we're going to win a Tony or an Oscar. You know, we're not in that world. But to be honored by receiving the Olivier Award for Best New Opera Production of the Year 37 years later was extraordinary to me. And it originally, we were only going to do the six cities that had commissioned the work. And then after the Olivier Award, we were invited to continue. And the artists who were part of that world for Einstein, because there were 70 people traveling, they were so committed to that work, because we didn't have the money or the budget to travel. We weren't sending things on air freight. So in between each city, we had to wait 2 months to get there. And the people, you're dealing with an entire freelance community. So they have to find other work and other commitments. But they were so committed to being a part of this journey that along the way, we lost very few. We had to do very little recasting. We did lose our production manager soon after the opening, and we had to bring a new production manager in who was from the circus world, actually. And I won't name any names, but after opening night at the Barbican, he told me that I was completely insane and I needed basically to rebuild the entire piece from the ground up. He would need $23 million. We should do the whole thing with projectors and get rid of Bob Wilson's hand-painted drops. And of course, we had just built Einstein for a little more than $2 million. Things were being held up on a shoestring and a beanbag backstage, but it was beautiful. And it was handmade and beautiful. He didn't last. He left. He left. He walked out and went back to Canada. And I had to find a new production manager, a dear old friend of mine, Mark Warren, who I worked with for years, who's now head of production at The Shed in New York. But he saved me, came back and stayed with the show.
Look, there's so many things I'd love to unpack, but I am conscious that the focus on this is for producers. And that one of the pieces of experience that you have that is very unusual is that you are in the position where you're asking people for large amounts of money that they will not get back. So nobody who invested in Einstein on the Beach made a profit, I think. Is my guess.
Yes, I will. I'm guessing. Yes, you're absolutely 100% right.
So how do you do that? What happens when you sit in the office and they say, what's the figure you need, Linda? And you go, it's probably your commissioning budget for the year plus a bit. And you're going to get every donor that you wanted to put into your capital appeal. And you're going to need a whole bunch of them to come along on this journey. Yeah. What happens? What's the inner monologue? And what do you say on the outside?
Well, first of all, I think my partners through this journey have been the presenting community and a small group in that community. And each project we do, I work with some of the people that I've known for the last 30 years on this journey. And there's always some new people, some newbies that come that we're very excited about to join that party. I think, you know, in scale, and it really is a difference of scale, because I will tell you, there was a huge difference getting people to commission Taylor Mack's 24-decade history of popular music, and we can talk about that as a part two. My first commission was getting $3,000, just the level. The highest commission was $30,000 for that piece. So the level is quite different in terms of how it was built and the level of investment versus Einstein. So with Einstein, I think there's two major commitments that the presenting partner needed to make. One of them was contributing to our overall budget of building Einstein, the pomegranate budget, where we were the infrastructure for the work and building the scenic elements, the costumes, dealing with the rehearsals, every aspect of that production. Because at Pomegranate for that production, we're also the general manager for the production. So we are a small company of six, but sometimes we have 200 people on salary because that's how large the work is. So there was contributing to this one overall budget, which was a combination of either giving some cash to the production or a lot of in-kind support. Like the contribution from an organization like UMS was vast in giving us a 3.5-week residency with local crew and technical costs and hotels covered. But on top of the contribution to our side of the production, each presenting partner, in order to do Einstein on the Beach, when you're looking at a 6-hour performance that you can do a maximum of 3 shows a week with a 4-day load-in, 3 or 4-day load-in on a pre-hang in a 2,000 or 3,000 seat theater, you have to sell every ticket out and you probably have to raise $1 million to just do it, to cover local costs, local crew, local marketing, your in-house theater and front of house expenses. The good news is that every single show of Einstein on the Beach sold out, and we thought it would, but still, even with that, you have to raise an enormous amount of money. And why would you do that? And often people in the field that when I speak to people outside of our field, they don't get it. Why would anyone invest this kind of money when you're not getting an investment back and you're only getting a thank you in the program? I think there are a lot of people in the world that understand the value and relevance of art and what it does to communities and how it changes communities. And I think the people that I work with, whether they're leaders, because they're artistic, I'm dealing with mainly the artistic institutions. Pomegranate does not have any funding directly as a company from institutions or foundations. We function because the work that we do and the projects that we do get funding from the not-for-profit art sector, mainly university presenters, arts institutions like the BAMS and Lincoln Centers of the world, and the international festivals, of which we are not a festival culture here. We do not do that well in America. There's a few little windows, as you know, from places like Luminato in North America or Spoleto, but like you in Australia or the Europeans, in the robust place for developing and commissioning and investing in new work does not happen here. So you really need to partner with institutions that you believe in you and know that you can actually deliver what you're going to deliver. And of course, the artists and the body of work and the impact that it's going to have in that art center community. Now, for Einstein on the Beach, I think it was unbelievably exciting for places like UMS, who made it, you know, in Ann Arbor, Berkeley, places that we've been to that the work has never been seen before, Los Angeles Opera, that they could share the work for the first time in its history of these three major artists. And also because of the success of Einstein, they were able to start new programs within those institutions. I mean, the success of Einstein, and you want this to happen, the success of a major contemporary opera can then go on to support development of new opera, like it with Beth Morrison Productions or whatever LA Opera is investing in, that they can see the importance of the success of a generational shift. From, you know, because when you're commissioning new work, you cannot just, or of course you can, but I feel like, of course, you want to commission emerging artists. You want to commission mid-career artists, but you need to commission major large-scale work that can fill halls and sell out halls of 2,000-3,000 seats to continue nurturing that level of audience as well in the performing arts. So most of the people that I work with, at the core, we all believe that the arts are a human right, not a privilege. I know that not everyone feels that way, but I think that for the cultural institutions that I work with, they see the value of something like Einstein on the Beach and what it does in the community, and the lasting impact is so much more tangible than a box office success. The box office success was there with Einstein, but it was much bigger. It became part of the curriculum, part of a new generation, part of a shadowing of generosity in the artistic community. So there was a lot that came of it. And also, I think people realized that if we were able to do this production, it could be filmed for the first time, which it was. We filmed it at the Châtelet on 10 cameras. It went out to the world for free on the internet. So all of a sudden, 8 million people were seeing Einstein on the Beach for free. We were getting emails from Burundi, Africa. Things were happening that we couldn't have imagined. And I think they're all the people that helped commission the work were very, very proud of what that work and the impact that that work had on their center and on their community. So
you've absolutely sold me on it. And if I'm a presenter, I want to buy this. I want to be a commissioning partner. I want to back the production 100%. But there's going to come a time in this meeting when you're going to have to say, and the figure is. Do you get nervous? I mean, it's the point where I suddenly go from being the great wolf to the small simpering puppy and feel like I've everything's about to fall apart because the number I'm going to raise, whether it's 1,000 or 1 million, it seems an outrageous kind of amount of money to pay for what I'm asking for.
No, I don't, because I think that a lot of, you know, some of the work we do is incredibly intimate and with all of the artists that we work with. And Einstein on the Beach is not, there are very few people that actually have the means to execute that work. And I am not going to be speaking to 200 people to do a show that they could present for $5,000. There's a lot of room, and I love, and we have done many, many shows that started in rooms for 50 people or 100 people, and they're meaningful and relevant. Einstein on the Beach not only needs someone who can pay for it, but they need a partner who actually is willing to have the bandwidth and the support that we trust too, that we trust to execute the work on behalf of that vision of the artist. When you are producing something like Einstein, very different from Taylor Mack, where Taylor does every single show is different. You're dealing with bringing 34 people and casting 150 local artists. So of course it's going to change in every city and every language and every culture. For Einstein on the Beach, you're trying to execute as a producer exactly the same thing, every single night, but in different size venues, different languages, different crews, different communities. So you have a very little time to slam dunk the quality of a production for an artist. And you have to trust that presenting partner and their community completely. So if I'm with Einstein on the beach. I'm not going to work with anyone who, you know, it doesn't matter actually if they just have the money. They have to actually have your trust and the experience with their crew. And I will say, by the way, Australia, one of the best in the world, and Melbourne, that crew. But you really need them to prepare. We had so much information. It was almost like we created Einstein on the beach for dummies. It was 18 months of preparation, of advanced trips, of meetings, of, you know, to know that there isn't really a lot of room for error in that ship. Where as a Taylor Mac production, there's a lot of room for calamity in the room. There's a lot of space for it, and it is completely welcomed. So it's a very different way of thinking about it, but still you need to work with partners who you trust.
I want to get into Taylor Mac in a moment, but just before that, this is a purely personal question, but what is your advice when you get that, you have that moment where you have to sort of name the figure? So a young producer is going to be in that position, and it might be $1,000 or $3,000, and they feel like it's a big ask, and it's an ask. They're not sure if they're going to if someone's going to roll their eyes or throw them out of the office. How do you deal with that moment?
How do I deal with it? I deal with it in that I'm incredibly transparent. For the partners that I work with, I actually share my budgets with them. I don't do this for everyone, but I do them with the people that take risks. I do them with the presenters who commission and produce themselves, or if they're not looking at a budget from me, I am walking through with them very clearly, because we're not this booking agency where a number just comes out of the sky. As you know, when you're actually building and making a work, you're aware of everything that needs to get to that place. So why is it so expensive? Why is, you know, people can do the math. We've got 70 people. They're here doing three shows. You're charging this much for three shows. So what they may not be thinking about is actually for a dance company to come and do those three shows, they're in rehearsal for 3 weeks prior to that so they don't get injured.
And you founded the dance company to make it happen.
Yes. So we're,
arc is extraordinary.
So the dance company, we're paying for the insurance, the salaries, the costuming, the shoes, the physical therapist, everything, the Philip Glass Ensemble, the instrument storage, whatever it takes to get the maintenance of the computers, the storage space for the scenic elements. There are elements that you do have to educate your partners in. Why does it cost this much? Understanding actually what it means when you're shifting and moving around 240-foot containers around the world, or airfares for companies, not to mention just the very basic structure of various government mandates on tax deductions for artists. You know, we all have different rules. You have different rules in Australia and Canada and America. Our rules in America, as you know, have changed after 9/11, when all of a sudden you're faced with taxes that really impact artist fees and really have a serious impact on the ability for cultural exchange in the performing arts. So you have to be transparent. I feel like I tend to really want to work with people who understand what it takes to get an artistic work like an Einstein on the Beach to the stage and not work in the vacuum. There were people on that tour that just thought, okay, great, we'll just pay the fee, just show up, we don't care. But very few of them felt that way. And plus, you know, when you're looking at a 26-page technical writer of the needs for a show, when you've got, you know, 2 weeks of 16-hour days with a local crew of 34 on top of your crew of 24 to execute it, you have to be able to have those conversations that are open and honest and transparent. And I think if people just don't want to understand it, they're probably not the right partner for the production.
Fantastic. I want to jump onto Taylor Mac, but before we do that, I was interested in the production of Available Light, particularly the recreation of the Frank Gehry installation into a set and the kind of reimagining of that. So was that something that was producer, could you talk a little bit about the project, but was that something that was producer driven, or was that something that was artist driven or opportunity driven? Where did it come from and how did you navigate the...
I'm so glad you asked. Actually, another question that's no one has ever asked me, and it's a really interesting moment. After Einstein on the Beach, I got a phone call from Bill Bissell, who is at the Pew Foundation in Philadelphia and an enormous advocate and supporter of Lucinda Childs. And he called me up and he said, Linda, Why Aren't You Doing Available Light? This is Lucinda's greatest masterpiece, one of the great pieces that the world has never seen. And now that you've done Einstein, you really should do Available Light. And I said, Bill, Pomegranate is not a company that goes back. Like we did Einstein, but we're really looking at new work. And I don't want to become the company that just goes back and remounts iconic work. We've done dance, we've done Einstein, and now we're going to stop this. You know, I have a dance company that I've been responsible for keeping on salary for 25 weeks a year to do this work. And it can't just keep going forever. Like we can't just become a dance company. But I said, I'm curious about this. He said, could I just send you the tape? So he sent me, I didn't know the work. I had never seen Available Light. And I knew it existed in a Lucinda Child's archival book that I had seen because I knew there was a BAM production. So I went back to look at this archival video and I couldn't believe it. I could not believe how magnificent this work was that none of us had seen before. So I went back and started digging into the history of this work and talked to Lucinda about the idea of, you know, what if we keep the company together a few more years after Einstein and try and we'll just do this other project. Available Light. And Lucinda was very excited and very supportive. And Bill Bissell at Pew said, if you do this, I'll help you. We'll do it in Philadelphia and we'll get the, you know, my friends at the Philadelphia Festival, the Fringe Festival, and Nick Stuccio to support it and we'll find a space for it. So we started looking into the research. I realized this work was created in 1983. It was in Los Angeles and the Contemporary Art Museum was closing for renovation and the Temporary Contemporary opened and there was this incredible woman there, Julie Lazar, who established a program where she was interested in bringing artists together from different genres who had never worked together. And she basically approached Lucinda to come up with what composer and what architect might you want to work with. At the time, you know, I can't actually remember, Lucinda and Julie were working very closely on this, but Lucinda was interested in working with Frank Gehry. At the time, he was not that known. And John Adams, who was living in Berkeley, and also at the time, not that known to Lucinda. Like she also had just done that one work with a composer, Philip Glass. He was the only composer she had worked with after working in silence. And the three of them came together to create this piece for the opening of the Temporary Contemporary with lighting designer Beverly Emmons. And it was created as a site-specific piece. So it was not built to tour. It was built as a dance floor with a second tier dance floor that cantilevered over the first with this company and Bauhaus looking beautiful costumes from a well-known fashion designer at the time. And it went to, I think, three cities. BAM did present the work, but they did a different version of it for the stage at the Opera House that is archived. And it was done once in France. And I think years later, a smaller reduced version of it was created at in London for a few nights at Queen Elizabeth Hall. So very few people knew this work. We approached Frank Gehry to see if he would be interested in meeting with us and exploring the idea with my production manager, Jeremy Leidick, who's wonderful and worked on Einstein and is a scenic builder maker, if we could come out and talk about creating a version of Available Light that was tourable that we could introduced to the world that would be modular and safe for the dancers. And Frank Gehry agreed. John Adams was absolutely thrilled that we were thinking about remounting this work that was seen only in four cities historically. And we brought a small group of commissioning partners together. Disney Hall was one of our commissioning partners along with Pew and the Philly Fringe Festival. And Disney Hall wanted to have the world premiere in Frank's Disney Hall. So it was, you know, for us, an extraordinary opportunity to work both with Frank Gehry re-envisioning this work with Lucinda and John. And we decided that, and we always like to work about 3 months before a world premiere so that if you're rebuilding and previewing some work, if something goes wrong, you have a few months to fix it. So we went up to Mass MoCA, up in North Adams, Massachusetts, and got a residency there with dear friends and colleagues. We do a lot of work up at Mass MoCA. And At the end of our residency, where we built the new Geary-designed production that our team built, Lucinda really wanted to work with the original costume designer, and the dancers were going to do two previews for as a work in progress as part of the residency. So we were going to try out this idea. The set was built. The company was extraordinary, and it was also one of the most difficult Lucinda works they have ever performed and I've ever seen. Not because of the movement, but because of the stillness in the piece. Because of the moments when the dancers have to stop and count. It is so challenging. And watching that work from a higher, looking down on the piece, you could absolutely see the sophisticated structure of how Lucinda scores and creates work and the patterns of it and the complexity of creating that work, which were for duets, trios, and quartets on two different levels, meticulously and intimately, but never touching each other. It's really an extraordinary piece. And when we were at Mass Mocha, the dancers put the costumes on and they couldn't move in the new costumes. The materials didn't work anymore. 30 years later, they were too stiff for the dancers and they couldn't move in them. And we had a performance the next night. The costumes were just done the night before the first work in progress. So the lighting design is very much about the color of the costumes, which are red, black, and white in available light. Very Bauhaus. It was a very specific look to that. And we found ourselves in the winter in the middle of Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, taking Lucinda Childs and the dancers to Dick's Sporting Goods store and Target to find sports clothes that would work on the dancers in black, red, and white so we could do this performance at Mass Mocha. Lucinda Childs had never walked inside a Target or a Dick's Sporting Goods store, so it was just like an amazing moment. And you know, we knew that we needed to bring in a new costume designer to work for these bodies and how these dancers were dancing all these decades later. We didn't have time for it. We knew we would have time for it before the premiere at Disney Hall. But I remember after the first work in progress, one of the audience members raised their hand because we had a Q&A after the first work in progress. And the first question the audience member asked was to Lucinda, what made you take an aesthetically different direction with the costume design and look of the show where you've decided to take more of a Paul Taylor approach?
It could have ended very badly at that moment, I imagine.
Oh my God. I just couldn't believe it. Anyway, you know, it worked out. We redesigned them, but that show was the impetus for us keeping this dance company together for 10 years. We toured Available Light all over the world. We just ended at Lincoln Center at Mostly Mozart. We filmed it. We then commissioned a new work for Lucinda for these dancers. So we did dance Available Light, Einstein on the Beach, and a new work over 10 years where Pomegranate became the entire infrastructure for a dance company for a decade. We disbanded the company last November where we went back and ended the early works in the atrium of MoMA before their renovation. It was a beautiful exhibition they did on the Judson era where they invited Lucinda to do the early works without music. And that journey of 10 years was really, really extraordinary for us. An artist like Lucinda, who didn't have a company for 10 years, who after this journey, all of these works have now been filmed. She won two Life Achievement Awards, the Golden Lion in Venice, and the ADF Award, and the work is now archived. It's in the National Museum of Dance. There's an exhibition at the Whitney. It's something actually we're really, really proud of because this is a woman who is one of the greatest choreographers of our time. Yet for some reason, you know, there was Merce, there was Pina, and there were all these incredible moments. But because she hadn't had a company for so long, it was almost like these works were not being remembered in a way, and the relevance of her work as an artist, as a choreographer, as a maker, as a scorer, of even the impact she had on a generation of how you score dance and how you mark that for the future was unexpected for us. And I think it was actually one of the great gifts at Pomegranate of having that opportunity with Lucinda that came out of really just wanting to produce Einstein and not knowing what that path would lead us to with her. And now some of her young dancers have started their own company, and we talked to Lucinda, who gave the rights to them for some of these early works to get started and have some financial support to do their own work, but also have the rights to these early works and continue creating an infrastructure for the people who hold the work for an artist, which I think is a really important conversation with artists and legacy and thinking about, you know, what Merce did so beautifully before he died and how he figured out a way to inspire us and support his community of dancers and producers and production team after he left, the people that cared for the work.
And are there ever moments when you say to an artist, it's enough, the elephants that you want for that extra scene, the extra 3 months of rehearsal, the moment where you want to flood the stage and, you know, yak's blood or whatever it is, like the next level of their dream where just you think, no, actually, that's not going to happen. We've got a show to open in 2 weeks' time or whatever. How do you deal with those moments?
Well, I tend to work with artists who are always willing to find a creative solution, honestly, because there are times when you have to say no and you can't do it. And if you're working with someone that you trust and that trusts you, there is always a creative solution. And, you know, one example, I guess I could use, I mean, there's 100 examples, but one example would be with Taylor when, you know, he was creating essentially 24 separate shows that we eventually put together into one 24-hour body of work, but it was really producing 24 small moments that then came together. And when Taylor was tackling the Great Depression, here we are again, the Great Depression. He decided we were trying out the idea and trying out those decades with Bill T. Jones at NYLA at his New York Live Arts space, very intimate space. And Taylor decided that he wanted a soup kitchen and that the whole audience was going to get soup. And I thought, you know, amazing. Like, this is an incredible idea, but I didn't really understand that once I dug in, started doing the research on the safety issues, on how we could execute that with allergies and, you know, cleanliness and all the ways to feed an audience and insurance and all those issues, we just couldn't afford to do it there. So, you know, I couldn't do it. I had to say no to the soup. But Taylor had a creative solution. He said, well, we're going to do it. We're just not going to do it with soup yet. We'll wait until we do the show in a bigger space and I'll, you know, put peanuts in. And then he was like, hilarious. He was like, you know, my producer couldn't afford the soup, so we're going to give you peanuts. You know, it was just, you know, and I love that. I love that about him. And I love, and Philip, even over the years, Philip is really one of the great collaborators when it comes to understanding the business of his work. There have been times where, you know, over the years where we've built new works and Philip would come in and sit and look at the budget with me. And I, you know, I'd say, Philip, we could do it. If we do it this way, we can bring it to, you know, this is how we can build it. This is how we can make it. This is what it means. And if we do it this way, these are the limitations. Let's make a decision together on what you want for this work. Now, of course, when we're not here, hopefully the work is going to be relevant in different ways and, you know, other people will interpret it their way. And that's a beautiful thing. But while you're here and you have an opportunity to make those decisions, the greatest thing is when you can make that decision with the artist. And there have been times where Philip has said, okay, we'll lose a tuba player or we'll, you know, do this or we'll do that. So I've never been in a position with an artist, whether it's, you know, Laurie Anderson, you know, one of the great, Laurie can think, you know, on any budgetary level. When people call me up years ago, now Laurie produces the work in-house at Canal Street Productions, but the years that we were producing some of the work with her, there was always a creative solution. And when people called me to commission something with Laurie, it's, you know, it's like, you know, you can make something for this or you can make something for this. And there is always a creative solution. So I think it becomes more difficult when there are certain parameters that you just can't do if you're a certain kind of artist. Like if you know that you're a circus, you're doing rigging And rigging costs a certain amount to be able to do it safely. You can't actually say no to that, right? When you have safety issues, there's no compromise, right? Safety issues for the artists and for the community. And then there are other times where, you know, there are, like with Sakai Juku, there was a time when Yushio Amagatsu was dancing, doing a solo with a peacock and flew plumage on stage. And there were issues there. There are issues.
Yeah. some of them presumably issues from the peacock's perspective too. Quick sidebar, but you've worked with this obviously extraordinary roster of people. We've talked about Philip Glass and Leonard Cohen, but also there's Aidan Harin. There's this kind of extraordinary stable of people, troop of people, tribe that you work with. Does that make it increasingly difficult to find the next one, the fresh and upcoming? Do you have to think this person's going to be a Philip Glass or a Leonard Cohen when they grow up, and I'm going to, you know, like they're going to have enough talent to warrant their place in the pomegranate constellation in 5 or 10 or 20 years' time?
You know, I never actually think that way. I guess I've been, you know, where you are in your life kind of puts you on a journey. You know, I don't think pomegranate, we've had so many journeys that are not obvious. Like we were the people who produced all the work with Dan Zanes for 10 years, the children's, you know, musical artist. And that came to us at Pomegranate because I had a child and I actually didn't want to spend the next 5 years of my life listening to the Wiggles. And I grew up with, I'm sorry that if you're in trouble with that, you can cut it.
I concur. I think they have a place in the world, but you know.
They have a place in the world, but I grew up with Woody Guthrie and Ella Jenkins, and I grew up with Pete Seeger. I grew up with social music. And I found that when I had my child, there wasn't anyone there doing the social music that I wanted. And I found Dan because he was doing that in a restaurant in the village. And I said, let's get together and do this on the road and let's go do this thing. And we collaborated, and that's how Philip Glass and Kronos and all this Lou Reed ended up on the records. And we did it for 10 years. And then I grew out of, my kids got older. And I'm like, I can't do this anymore because I'm going to do Einstein on the Beach. I'm just going to do something else. And Dan's still a great friend. And in fact, he was our mandolin player in the Taylor Mack show.
Fantastic.
And still a wonderful artist. I think with Taylor, I met Taylor through I don't know if you know Creative Capital, but it's an incredible organization that funds artists in America. And Taylor was one of the artists who was a Creative Capital funded artist and did this incredible work, Lily's Revenge, that Elisa, my partner, and I got an opportunity to experience while we were doing Einstein. And we just, you know, you have a response to an artist that's so personal that you feel, and I felt that way about Diamanda Galás, who was part of my life for 12 years and changed my life. I don't think in many ways I'd be doing what I would be doing now without Diamanda, but that was 1987 and a whole other story and path during the AIDS epidemic. But it's an artist who changes the way you think about the world, or an artist that moves you so deeply and brings so much authentic truth into the room that cuts through the bullshit, that I feel like that's the artist that I will do anything for. It's not about who's the next, you know, who's the next Philip or who's the next. But when you feel that, and I did feel that with Taylor, and I did feel that with Taylor so deeply when he was workshopping this early version and idea of wanting to do the 24 decade, that I feel like I would give my life for him. Like, I'm just like, this is amazing. You feel like you just trust that if you are able to be moved by an artist so deeply, whether it's Philip or Leonard or Diamanda or Taylor, or whoever that is, whether they're known, whether they're not known, a Noni, you know, who was life-changing for us on the Leonard Cohen show that our friend Hal Wilner, we got to produce that with Rachel Chanoff and our colleagues, the Leonard Cohen tribute. It is very clear when an artist has that kind of authentic voice and they have the ambition and trust to go on a journey with you. The combination of it, I think, is rare. I think the combination of how many times does it happen when an artist changes your trajectory in life? I think it has happened to me a few times. It's happened to me maybe 4 or 5 times, maybe 6 times. And I feel right now, people are talking to me about what are you doing now? What are you doing during COVID? And like, how are you thinking about this? And I guess, you know, it's really interesting because, of course, like so many other people in the field, we have no work. Everything we did canceled and is bottoming out. And yet I'm not interested in creating work in, you know, I feel like I just want to do what we've always done because the artists that we are working with or the artists in the world that have authentic voices that want to partner with a producer. Not everyone needs a creative producer. Not everyone needs a pomegranate or whatever, whoever company they're working with. They're always, if they stick to their authentic voice of just making work, not in response to something, but just as an artist, that work is the work that is going to be relevant 50 years from now. And there are ways to do it differently now. There will be ways because it will be challenging. And there are artists that are going to make work in smaller ways. And it's not all going to be about running into a theater and being together right now, but we will get there. And the work that's created now is going to be very, very relevant in 50 years from not everything that's coming out, because there's some great stuff coming out and some horrible stuff. But I think it's an exciting time, as challenging as it is.
Linda, what would your advice be to your younger self?
I think my advice would be not to be invisible. And I think that the way that artists are creating work today, it is a beautiful partnership with creative and independent producers to have. And I think that particularly in the performing arts, cultural ecology and landscape, we have had to find ways to navigate the system that I think a lot of the structures are really archaic in that even when you fill out a grant or you're sending a budget to a presenter, there's only a line for an agent or a manager. Not even, we are the other, the creative, we're the other. So I think we have to stop being the other. And I would say that whether you choose to call your company your own name or something else, it really doesn't matter. It's having a seat at the table because the seat at the table is really relevant. And I would love to be in a position and look at a world where this sector is growing in more diverse ways on every level, geographically, every level of every diversity within a person. I think what's very challenging right now is that there is no income base that's inspiring. Like if you don't take the risk, there's no salary. So I think that we have to have a seat at the table. So those systems of support that exist globally for the creative producer, like yourself, need to be just there, just to have a seat with the rest of it, because it's part of the ecology that is really important. And I think we shouldn't be embarrassed to talk about that seat, to talk about the economy of it, to talk about the money of it, the business of it. We all believe in supporting artists and work, and this is a very relevant business and probably one of the most important parts that I believe is going to heal us as a society in rebuilding ourselves.
I'm Yaron Lifshitz, and you've been listening to Producing Heroes, the Circa podcast, produced by Lauren Isaacson. If you've been listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. And if you like what you've heard, you can find us on social media at Circa Contemporary Circus, #ProducingHeroes.